All right, if we can turn our attention now to agenda paper three, having resolved all the other IFRS 2 issues now, there's just one little thing that's crept along. Jay-ho, do you want to introduce this paper to us?
There is another IFRS 2 issue, so please look at agenda paper 3. Agenda paper 3 is addressing the occasion on which the entity terminates employment, and therefore the share-based payment is nullified. As for this occasion, there are diverse views as to whether to see it as a forfeiture account event or a cancellation event, because then, so we received a request to clarify the accounting treatment for this occasion. So looking at the current IFRS 2 guidance, on one hand, paragraph 19 of IFRS 2 requires that if a grant of equity instruments does not vest because of the failure to satisfy a service condition, no cost should be recognized for service on cumulative basis. On the other hand, paragraph 28 of IFRS 2 requires that if a grant of equity instrument is cancelled during the vesting period, the entity should recognize immediately the remaining cost that otherwise would have been recognized until the vesting date. However, there is no specific guidance on the effect to the share-based payment resulting from the entity's termination of employment. We think views are diverging because a focus may be differently placed between the two aspects of this single event. In one aspect, the employee fails to satisfy the service condition, so which, no matter what the reason is, which results in forfeiture accounting. And in the other aspect, the entity terminates the employment at its will, which results in cancellation accounting. There is also another view making a difference based on the reason that the employee fails to complete the specified service period. We believe that the entity's termination of employment is a forfeiture event as far as current IFRS 2 is concerned. Current IFRS 2 regards the employee's failure to complete a specified service period as failure to satisfy a service condition and does not make any difference as to why the employee failed to complete a specified service period and also isolate the cancellation events from the instance where vesting conditions are not satisfied. We also looked into the accounting firm's public guidances on this issue. In our opinion, there is predominant view supporting a forfeiture accounting in practice, even though multiple views are competing. The relevant guidance are put together in Appendix D. In conclusion, we recommend the entity's termination of employment should be seen as a forfeiture event, regardless of the reason that the entity terminated employment. In our opinion, the issue satisfies the committee's agenda criteria. However, we recommend these issues should not be taken onto committee's agenda item as a separate issue, but rather included within the current committee agenda item, vesting and non-vesting conditions project. As part of that project, we recommend updating the definition of service condition to take into consideration this issue. The proposed new definition of service condition is laid out in agenda paper 2C. Does the committee agree with that recommendation?
Thanks.
Well, first of all, I was struck by the headline calling it termination of an employee. I would have thought we should call it termination of the employment.
Sometimes being concise is not always correct.
I don't see a difference between, if we say we call it a feature, and so I don't see a real substantial difference between view A and view C, because as the cancellation is within the company's decision, they can cancel the contract and then fire the employee. So they can have view, if we call it a forfeiture, they can also have a cancellation beforehand, can't they? So they can, it's completely within the company's decision. If it's a cancellation of a feature, if we call it a forfeiture, if they don't terminate and then fire him.
That would be very silly, wouldn't it? Because then they get different accounting, which they wouldn't necessarily like.
Yeah, but they can have the accounting they want. If we call it a forfeiture, they can also have a cancellation, if they want. Maybe they don't.
You do remember what the consequences of a cancellation are.
Right, but...
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but technically it's the same as view C, I think.
Right. Yeah.
I had a lot of sympathy for view C because it makes a lot of sense to me to distinguish between bad service that's been provided and that's why people are laid off. I understand that might be a problem in practice to distinguish between those two, but so I said for to make it easier and not have to make this distinguishment, we could go to view A. But then I see the same problem that Bernd has seen. There's some area for misuse here. I could imagine a situation where you not cancel the plan but lay off 99% of your employees and would say, well, it's a forfeiture and I have the nice accounting that I have for future and not the bad one for cancellation. So that is really the thing that worries me about saying, well, every layoff is a forfeiture and not a cancellation of a plan. Otherwise, I understand why the staff says, also looking at the standard, why the staff says, well, let's make it easy. Every layoff, every termination of an employment is a forfeiture. That makes it easy. But as I said, I don't know what the views of the other committee members are. I had a lot of sympathy for view C, which makes more sense to me than view A.
Jean-Louis?
I support the view expressed by the staff. I think that, to come back to the point raised by Guido, view C...
If there is finally a legal dispute with the employee, in case of misconduct or no value will be attributed to share-based payment because there will be no performance or service supply. I mean, there will be, in fact, no indemnity. And in the other situation where it's a decision of the company which is not in relation with the misconduct of the employee, the indemnity will incorporate the share-based payment value. So I think the distinction is not needed, and if we follow the way of cancellation, we could have such situation where you have expense twice, in fact, one through the cancellation process and one through the indemnity.
I have a different view. I have a concern that the abuse of using forfeiture, if we go to view A, because the employers and the employee is not standing on the equal footing. And as you said, that it's a unilateral contract, because employer could terminate the contract if he would like at the day, just the day before the termination contract, and then so that they can cancel, they can reduce their expense. I don't think such kind of abuse happens so often, but if the accounting standard stipulates that only the forfeiture is possible accounting for this kind of situation, then the some employers may think that it's a good idea to use the forfeiture. So I rather feel the danger to go to just view a forfeiture. So I rather prefer to leave the room for the UC to make a judgment for the, of the employees.
Taka, I'm not quite sure. I understand your concern about the employer choosing one or the other. If the scheme itself, the broader scheme or the scheme as it applies to an individual, is cancelled, then that would result in an acceleration of the remaining expense under the cancellation. If that was done and then a month later the employee's services were terminated, then that would still be accounted for as a cancellation. If, on the other hand, no change was made to the plan, the employee services were terminated, there's no need to cancel the arrangement because the employee is not going to continue to provide the service and therefore will never earn, never meet the vesting requirements to earn the award. So that I think is what the staff is proposing, is treated as a forfeiture. What is your concern about trying to look at the reason why an employee has had services terminated?
I misunderstood the proposal of the staff, but what I thought was if accounting treatment is just a forfeiture, then the employer could terminate the employment contract just the day before the contract period.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the event of the termination, they could they could reimburse the expense which they have recognized beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And such kind of accounting treatment may induce employers' behavior. That is my concern.
That a company might fire people a month before their options vest to get the reversal of expense and then hire them back? I mean, to me, the decision to fire an employee is a lot bigger than canceling an option.
Mm.
You know, certainly I think I could foresee an abuse. You fire your employees, reverse the expense, and then a week later hire them back, but I think we would probably all look at that and say, effectively, that's a cancellation. That you ought not get forfeiture accounting there, and so if we think we need to draft it in a way to make sure that that abuse can't happen, you know, I'm fine. But to me, the decision to fire an employee is a pretty substantive one, and I'm okay with saying if you really do fire the employee and it's not some scheme to just cancel the option but continue employment, if you really are firing the employee, I think UA, it's a forfeiture, is the right answer. And I think that's what the standard is based on the assumption that the employment relationship has substance beyond the stock option arrangement or beyond the share-based payment arrangement, and therefore a decision by the employee or employer to terminate that arrangement is quite substantive and is different than simply canceling the share-based payment award, which is equivalent to reducing salary. So I understand why there would be a difference, and, you know, to me, view A is the logical answer, and I think the abuse that we could make up that somebody might try to take advantage of the VUA, I would have thought that, you know, we would all have objected to that anyways, saying that, you know, substantively the employee is providing the service because you hired them back right away.
Well,
I just same type of remark as Scott has made. I think the company does not terminate a contract with an employee aiming only to avoid the share-based payment. And this is not the reality. This could happen, but I don't see a situation where seriously it could be meant that way. And probably there will be a litigation after that, and the employee will win. So. So the anti-abuse clause, the anti-abuse vision you mentioned, I think there's no real risk in my view. So I still think that VUA is appropriate.
Perhaps anticipating Lawrence's comments that employee services have to be substantially terminated, not fully terminated. Ross.
I agree with VUA as a correct reading of the standard, in addition to making sense economically. The comment I will have is respect to question two, to include it in the project vesting and non-vesting conditions. I think it will depend on the timetable of the outcome of that project. I'm not sure that there is much diversity out there currently on this interpretation. So if the project on vesting and non-vesting conditions is pushed away for many months, I would rather have something, you know, stating the views of the committee if the committee goes for view A, either in the form of, I don't know whether just an agenda rejection is sufficient or not, because it's the reading of a standard.
Yeah, the decision we took before the break was in effect to put all of these vesting condition issues to the board, and I think the modification that comes now is that this will be included within that list that goes to the board if you accept that. And based then on the feedback we get from the board, then we can take a decision as to what, if anything, we then do with it. Yeah. Okay. Ruth?
I support VUA, but agree with Laurence that I don't think this needs to be wrapped up in the other project. I think we could clearly deal with this on its own, either through an agenda decision or through an annual improvement to clarify.
But you're okay, as the other one is going to the board, to include that one within there rather than dealing with it, with this one separately now?
But I think we could deal with it separately. I think if there's agreement that it's VUA, unless there's major disagreement.
Later we could deal with it separately as opposed to now. I mean, do you want to take this one forward on its own now and not report it to the board and deal with it?
I think we could. It seems reasonably simple to me that we could deal with it now.
Would it make any sense to do it that way and separate it from the other? I think the reason that this is included in the discussion now is it seems to be similar. It's related to the other items that are going forward.
Yes, it was because it's relating to a similar area that we thought it would be more efficient to include in the other project. Obviously, that was on the assumption that we were moving forward with the other project.
But I'm not sure that it's linked to the other project. I mean, it seems to me you can answer this question without having read any of the agenda papers to A, B, and C, and all of the conversations we've had before. It seems to me it is not linked to it. So I don't know why we would need to defer dealing with it by wrapping it up into that project if we think it's reasonably clear and we can deal with it separately.
Okay. Andrew?
Well, I think I'd probably agree with Ruth that if we wanted to, we could deal with it separately. But on the other hand, I mean, it's got IFRS 2 in front of it, and if we're going to put something to the board on IFRS 2, I don't mind it going there, and part of the reason for that is I'm not convinced there's an awful lot of diversity in practice, so I don't think we need to rush to do much. So I wouldn't favour doing anything in isolation, personally.
Okay. And Guido?
Yes, well, I was convinced by the argument. I'm also not in favour of UA. but then I have a question to the staff, because I, as I understand, you included this view A already in your proposal in paper 2C. My understanding is that view A is whatever the causes for the termination of the employment, it's a forfeiture. But when I look into 2C in B41A, you define vesting conditions and you say, well, the condition, blah, blah, results in vesting on a termination without cause. Aren't you making the distinction then there? Is it with a cause or without a cause?
But that's in 2C, if you take those comments offline. Yeah. Right. So, general view is that we include this item within the other issues that go to the board. And then wait for a report back at the next meeting. And then if we decide to deal with this differently from any of the other proposals, through an agenda decision or through interpretation, we can discuss the item there. So we'll wait for you to come back with the staff recommendation. Okay. So, Michael, thank you very much for that. And it's time to call David. And talk to us about these little options that he's been holding in reserve for us. We should have five papers altogether for agenda item 4, but we'll let David just start by giving us an overall view.
Accounting for put options written over non-controlling interest, obviously we had plenty of discussion on this issue over the last, I think, two meetings. I thought I'd just start actually with agenda paper 4A, gives a little bit of an overview of the papers we intend on talking through today. I think since 4A was posted, there has been one addition, which is agenda paper 4E. Just the request of some of the committee members to give a few example journal entries supporting some of the technical analysis that was included in some of the papers. However, I think rather than jumping into the technical parts of the paper, I really wanted to start off today by just giving a bit of an overview of where we are to date with the project. Quick summary of some of the issues, the technical analysis that is in the other papers we've included here, but really focus on getting some initial thoughts from the committee on the direction of the project and really thinking through some of the options that are discussed in agenda paper 4D. With that in mind, just want to start with agenda paper 4A and highlight two paragraphs in there. The first of which is the first paragraph, just summarising the specific requests that we received on this issue. And just to note, really, that the request was around how an entity should account for changes in the carrying amount of a financial liability for a put option written over shares of a non-controlling interest shareholder. I think this is quite important to highlight because the staff analysis to date has also expanded the scope, I think, of that question to address some other issues. So there may be some that view that the specific question in the request could be addressed in isolation. I think others would say that some of the additional analysis that we've done to date and that is included in these papers is important in terms of the context of the question and developing views on what may on the face of it look like a relatively narrow question. The other paragraph I just wanted to highlight was paragraph 5 in agenda paper 4A. This is a summary of the two tentative agenda decisions that the committee have made so far, realising that these are in the context of the analysis that the staff have provided to date. So the first of those was that on initial recognition, a financial liability would be recognised for these puts, and that would be measured at the present value of the redemption amount of the put. and that was a read predominantly of IS32. And then secondly, the subsequent measurement on changes in the carrying amount of a financial liability would be recognised in profit or loss, reading more directly from IS39. So, again, sort of thinking through that, you know, some may have a view that that second tentative agenda decision is actually answering the specific question that we were asked in the request. However, I think it's fair to say that despite the tentative agenda decisions and potentially the sort of narrowness of the requests we received here, there are a number of concerns that have been raised in the staff analysis and in the discussions with the Interpretations Committee to date. Many of these are summarised in Agenda Paper 4D. So I thought maybe I'd just sort of summarise a couple of those and then say, certainly get some views from the committee on the next steps here. So I think one of the first sort of concern areas that's raised throughout the papers has been whether an interpretation of current IFRSs on this issue is going to lead to an improvement in financial reporting. We've heard some concerns around whether there is conceptual rationale for the changes being recognised in profit and loss rather than in equity. And we've also heard, I think, some views and discussed some views around whether the derivative approach that currently is proposed in the FICE project may be preferable to the current gross liability accounting approach in IS 32. I think the second issue we've discussed is a lot of discussion on the initial recognition piece of it and whether that question needs to be addressed here in order to give an answer to the request. We've discussed a little bit the economic benefits approach and noted there may be some concerns there around what we call double counting issues in these papers. And we've contrasted that a little bit with a reclassification of NCI approach, which I think was brought to the table a little bit in our July discussion. We note, I think, in our analysis here that some may have concerns with that approach, whether the requirements in IS 32 should be interpreted that way or are meant to be. In other words, is that really expanding the scope of what's currently in 32? And secondly, some have concerns, I think, with the notion of reclassifying the NCI or maybe viewing NCI as being derecognized when a put is written. The third summary point just wanted to raise was, you know, we've certainly included some consideration around whether the board may be supportive in amendments here. You know, maybe that's an alternative approach to interpreting the current literature. I think some would view that may get us to a better place with financial reporting, but certainly we have some concerns with how that fits in with the current FICE project and, you know, whether that project is going to address part or some of these issues, or whether the board would want to proceed with something separate outside of the FICE project to address this narrow issue. So with that in mind, I think I'd like really to pose the question we include in Agenda Paper 4D, which was getting some views from the committee on whether they think it's appropriate with this issue to move forward with an interpretation. And I say, I think after that in mind, we'll maybe get into some of the more technical analysis as and when.
Okay, thanks, David. Just to remind you as well, because it's unusual that the committee actually does some work when the board has a current project on the same topic. That's usually a reason why we don't do anything. When this first came to the committee's attention, the board project was moving somewhat ahead, and this issue was not specifically addressed and wouldn't have been addressed within that project. So the feeling of the committee, just to remind you, was that we could have some deliberation, provide some input then into the board, and perhaps then to bring the two together. So if this was a sufficiently important issue, that we could address it, as it were, in the interim, but then it would be finalized as the board finalized its proposals on the financial instruments with characteristics of equity project. Subject to is taking that original decision, the board, together with FASB, has reconsidered its timetable. And so the timetable for the publication of the ED on the FICE project isn't at the end of the second quarter of this year, as you might have noticed, that that was not something that was published, that it's slated for publication in the first quarter of next year. So there is another alternative that's available to us now, which I think is what David's alerting you to, as to whether we should actually be proceeding with the interpretive process, or if in fact we should just implore the board to do more work on fixing this particular problem. But with that extra little bit of background and David's introduction, open for comment. Ruth?
Just overall comment, I think David is what you're asking for at this point. I support the direction that the staff are taking in these papers. I think your proposed resolution of the double counting issue through the reclassification of NCI approach seems to work. Acknowledge there are some other issues that we need to sort through, such as what happens if the foot is not exercised, how do you deal subsequently. But I like the way that it resolves the issue, and it seems to resolve it better than the FICE project, because the FICE approach seems to only work when the put option has no value or very low value, whereas this one seems to address both situations. So in general, I like the approach that you're taking, and I would encourage us to proceed with it through an interpretation with some amendments to the standards that would need to go with it.
Okay. Jean-Louis?
I don't share the opinion expressed by you. I think there is really an internal lack of consistency between some parts of 32, 39 and IS 27, namely paragraph 19 and IG 5 to 7, and that should be considered from the beginning of to the end of the transaction. And in my view, without entering into the technical details of paper 4B, the solution developed by the staff in order to avoid double accounting and maybe to mitigate P&L effect does not reflect the economics and legal aspect of the deal, because it considers that the option has been exercised from the beginning, which is not true, and would not be appropriate to cover the treatment of maybe of dividend and the final treatment of the put exercise or not. So and maybe could create opportunity for structuring, because people could then treat the option from the beginning as being exercised and then cancel it, taking the results from the minority and then cancel the agreement. So. I think that my two views are that this issue cannot be solved through an interpretation because of the lack of coherence of I expressed from the beginning between 32, 39 and 27. And the solution developed in paper 4B is not appropriate in my view.
Okay. Luca?
In general, I agree with the need to go on the interpretation and not wait for the more comprehensive project made by the board. Even though I share in part the idea of Jean-Louis, that's especially, but we will have a question to speak about this, what is written especially in paper 4B does not necessarily reflect the economic substance, and I'm a little bit scared about the idea to avoid the recognition non-controlling interest inside the consolidated financial statements. I have the fear that the medicine is worse than the injury in this case. So it's absolutely clear and understandable the effects of double counting, but I would like to stress the fact that this is an aspect, but we have to also consider the economic substance of the non-controlling interest in size.
Okay. Joanna?
First of all, I'd like to thank David for giving us the overview before we perhaps go into the detail of looking at the technical stuff, because I really think it's very important to think about where we're going on this. And when we read paper 4D, to me, there are some real concerns around the process and what we're doing versus the FIFE project, and that the timing of that, in that we seem to be going a different direction, and that worries me. Whether or not we agree with paper 4B, i.e. the technical arguments, if it's going a different direction from the board, is that doing anybody, our constituents, any good if we put out something that is different from where the board might be heading? And to me, what this has come, and we've gone into a lot of detail, we've almost opened Pandora's box, and partly, me, right from the start, saying, I don't understand this, David, what's the basic accounting? And we've gone from there. But to me, perhaps we should be feeding this information into the project and saying, this is a big issue. You've got to make sure that within that project, and they've now got some more time, that this feeds into that. But I do come back to the possibility of, as David said, effectively, if you actually look, and it's your last paragraph in 4D as well as your first paragraph in 4A, what the question was we were actually asked, we could, I believe, by the tentative decision that we made last time, because the question is simply, what do you do with the liability? Not double counting or any of that, but what do you do with the liability? We could actually issue a very simple, almost rejection statement saying, well, it's 39. And so we don't have to deal with all of those issues about 27 and 32 and 39 if we felt that that was the way to go. Because I personally have a real concern that, yes, we're doing an awful lot of work and it's good work, but is it doing our constituents any good if the FIFE project is going to come out with something different?
Yes, I would agree with Joanne, and I felt the same way. I had actually asked if I could see P accounts and journal entries for some of these.
You're the journal lady.
I'm the journal lady. I'm the one that has to bookkeep all these things, you know, so I want to understand what this exactly means, and the only way to do that is debits and credits. But I would agree with Joanne that for us to come out with any type of guidance in thinking that the board is going to come out with the FICE project and the results that's going to be contradictory, I think it would be very, very confusing to preparers and to users of financial statements.
Okay. Laurence?
I do not believe that we will be able to solve this issue through an interpretation because it's too complex. I also share the views expressed by Jonah and Peggy that it would be counterproductive going one way if the board is going another way. In addition, I really don't like the staff proposal in agenda paper 4B, because I think it's not solving the issue. The double counting effect is not being solved by the solution in 4B, plus the fact it negates the rights that non-controlling interests have in the entity by saying it's just a financial liability. This is not true. Non-controlling interests still have an interest in the subsidiary, and this is not being faithfully reflected in the financial statements with the proposed accounting. So I can definitely not support the direction proposed in paragraph 4B. I have other suggestions if we really want to have a quick fix that I'm not going to express here. We can discuss later on, but I can offer to the committee some other quick fix if we want to move fast on those issues. But I don't think it can be solved through an interpretation.
Okay. Scott?
Well, I think we could do this quickly by just answering the question asked. 39 says P&L. And I agree with Joanna, that's basically a rejection notice. I think we could do that. It would be faithful to answering the questions that's asked. I think what we discovered as we discussed this, though, was that while we think it's clear that the change in the liability goes through P&L, we do think that that can create some situations where there's double counting. And so without us giving more guidance, we're going to wind up leaving people in a difficult situation. For example, 4B, paper 4B proposes an approach. I'm not terribly fond of it, but it does solve the double counting issue. Laurent says it doesn't. I don't see that. I think it absolutely solves the double counting issue. It says you will count it once as a liability. All done. I don't particularly like that answer, but it does solve the double counting issue. But I don't think anybody could get there if we don't do something. In other words, if all we do is say, you asked us where the change in the liability goes, the answer is P&L, I seriously doubt that anybody would have gotten to the answer in 4B. So if we want to provide help for the double counting, I think we keep going. With respect to the FICE project, maybe I'm overly skeptical, but I'm not confident that it's going to be finished anytime soon. And even if it is finished anytime soon, it ain't going to be applied until 2014. So we still got a lot of time under the current guidance. I happen to prefer the way the FICE project is going, treating this thing as a derivative, not as a gross liability. But the fact of the matter is, we can't make that change now. Because in order to make that change now, we'd have to do the same thing with put options on parent company equity. And that's way beyond what we can do here. So I think our best solution at this point is to keep going. We've answered the question that was asked. We know the answer, but we'd like to resolve some of the issues that weren't asked, but that we see obviously appearing. And I think we ought to take a shot at finding a model that at least helps resolve some of those problems. If we fail, then next meeting we may come back and say, all right, all we can do is answer the question that was asked and leave everything else for later. But I'm not ready to give up yet. Even though I don't like the model that was proposed last meeting and I don't like the model that was proposed this meeting, I'm not ready to give up.
Thanks for that encouragement. Guido?
Well, as far as the reclassification approach is concerned, I share the concerns of other committee members that doesn't portray the economic situation, not showing that there is still non-controlling interest, that there is still non-controlling interest that is entitled to dividends, and just wiping that out doesn't make sense to me. Although I understand that might solve one of the double counting issues, only one of them in the balance sheet. But I think the real problem that we have in the P&L is not attributing part of the profit and loss to non-controlling interest, which is still there, which is portrayed to be one of the double counting issues in P&L. But I think the real problem is that we show a gross liability and that we show changes of this gross liability through P&L. That's the real problem. And I think we cannot deal with that. That's the FICE project. That's the board has to deal with these issues. Now, with regard to what Scott just said, I'm not that optimistic that we can solve the question that was asked was as easy as it has been assumed by some of the committee members. Putting the answer into an agenda decision, that's not IFRS and it's not an interpretation. So that will not solve the problem because I can still see some good arguments out there in certain conditions that you say, well, this is a contingent consideration, not within a business combination. IAS 27 might tell you, or 28 might tell you that this is part of the acquisition cost and you don't charge it through P&L. So I still see that there might be some arguments, good arguments, not to put it through P&L, and it doesn't help the people out there if they put something into an agenda decision. So either my proposal would be, and I thought about that this morning and I couldn't come up with the right answer. I still have a problem with it. Either we take it off the agenda and say to the board, you know, you take care of it in your FICE project, even if it takes up until 2014. Or what we could do is to propose something for an alien improvement project which changes IS-39 in a way that, I'm just thinking from the top of my head, that changes in this liability might be charged directly to equity, because I think that's a concern that people have, not only for put options on non-controlling interest, but also for the other put options that we have talked about. And I'm thinking about it, we may come up with a solution that is comparable to the solution of credit risk for liability, so that you show the changes in P&L, but take it out of P&L, then equity. I know that's not a perfect solution, I know, but I think that's the only, if we want to help people out there and we think the problem is showing the fair value changes through P&L, which I think is that's the problem that we need to solve, then that would come to my mind as one of the solutions. In between, if we say it's too long until 2014 for the board to come up with a solution, so we need to have something in between. So yeah, that's the best solution that I can think of.
Thank you, Guido, for those very constructive remarks. But to put it in context, if this was something that was to go through annual improvements, assuming that we could complete it for this year's exposure draft, which would presumably go through for board approval sometime next year, 2011, that would be effective 2013, would it?
Yes. Yes, it would.
So that going through annual improvements, if we're expeditious and if we can all agree, might save a year on what we're speculating would be the board timetable. Andrew?
I suppose Capricorn, I think derivative is and always was the right answer, but unfortunately we can't go there under the current standard. In terms of the various issues that we're talking about, I don't think there's much chance of us getting swift agreement on where the initial debit goes. So based on previous discussions, that would seem an uphill struggle. I do think the answer to the question that was asked is straightforward. I think the equity transaction is the granting of the option, and what happens to it afterwards is measurement under 39. And I do think we could answer that quite quickly. When we started this discussion, I was rather assuming we'd reach a simple conclusion and do an agenda decision, but maybe not. If it has to be an interpretation, then fair enough, and then perhaps we need to keep working under on a different sort of timeline on some of the other issues. But I think the answer to the question is pretty straightforward, and we could deal with it.
Laurence, you'd like it to go on and off.
Yeah, I just wanted to say to committee members that the alternative suggestion for some quick fix I was working on are in the same line as Guido's, and I can explain to you how to do the quick fix, which is a simple addition to paragraph 47 of IS 39. It doesn't require much modification, but it would effectively account initially as the staff proposed, but subsequently had an exception to the measurement of financial liabilities in IS 39. So I'm not talking about the scope exemption, but just within IS 39 say that liabilities related to put options or put instruments related to subsidiaries, changes are accounted for against equity. That would be, I worked out some words. It's not that big.
So unlike the IFRS 2 amendment, which we thought didn't really change the accounting, although it involved a lot of words, this one involves very few words, but it's completely different to any other accounting for changes in a liability. Okay. Ruth?
Well, given the staggering support for my initial papers, I remain supportive of what the staff have proposed, but I think If we did what Joanna and Andrew suggest we do, which is to say IS 39 is clear, you take the changes through P&L, which I think we could do, we're not going to solve the practice problem and that the resistance in practice to doing that, which is the double counting result, which is why we asked the staff to go down the path of seeing if there was a solution to the double counting problem, which I think they have found at least one approach which I think does work. I think the resistance I'm hearing now is that you, some of you don't like that approach because you're saying in substance there is still a minority, and so you don't like the, sorry, an NCI, so you don't like the reclassification approach. But the practical reality is that that does solve the double counting issue. So personally, I'd be supportive of just issuing an agenda decision that says I-39 says take it through P&L, but I can anticipate we'll get thousands of letters telling us that there's a double counting problem if we do that. And that's why I think we should proceed with trying to solve the problem. Perhaps what we did with IFRS2 is we need to go back to the board and say, how would you like us to proceed? Is the FIGHT project going to continue this way, or would you like us to explore another way? But I don't think it is as simple as issuing an agenda decision saying the change goes through P&L, because we'll be here for months dealing with the letters that come in.
John?
I support the staff position. I think within the context of the current standard, the right answer is the reclassification. The reclassification doesn't change the economics of minority interest, of the non-conforming interest. It just says where you classify it on the balance sheet. What's the trouble, I guess, is once you're in the liability side, then you're stuck with the rules of the liability side, which says P&L. But I think I'd like to address the reclassification. I think just answering the minimus question would not solve anything. So I think we should go there. Now we're stuck in the category of we're on the liability, and there is obviously a disconnect in the measurement. If I'm on the liability, though, I have a benefit that if the subsidiary is profitable, then because it's a liability, I have no attribution of profit. I would recognize 100% of the profit, so I pick up a certain benefit. Then my liability goes up, then I have a negative amount. There's a disconnect between the measurement of the two. That's the problem. Then I recognize that. But I still think that we should go there. We should get there. And then the next question would be, because we know and we see this disconnect, do we want to suggest an amendment to IS-39, which I think is a major change, personally, because liabilities goes to P&L. Liabilities, I don't know that there are so many liabilities that goes to equity at the moment in the current literature. I'd like to see that it's not such a major change. One alternative that I would even prefer would be a measurement of the liability that would be aligned with the non-controlling interest attribution. Having said that, I'm not too sure what the solution is once you're up there in the liability side, but I'd like to go there.
When I recall the discussion of the last meeting correctly, one of the major reasons why we took this forward was that we are not going to fit it into the FICE project because they are going to issue something in the near future. Now the situation has changed. They're going to issue it next year, so we can fit it into. And then to me, the whole thing does not meet our agenda criteria anymore, because we can fit it in an active project that will issue something in the near future. And it's an ED. They issue an ED or discussion. They issue an ED. So although it might take some time to issue a final standard, this is something that should be in the FICE project, especially if they come up with a different answer. Because I cannot see that if we issue something and the answer of the FICE project is different, Then what will the constituents or the preparers do? They do something based on our interpretation or whatever we issue. At 2 years' time, they have to change that because the FICE project comes up with something else. And the FICE project cannot just ignore what we do, because if they are of a different opinion, they cannot say, well, they issued something, we see it differently, but we ignore it. They have to overrule it to some extent. So I think it should be referred to the FICE project. If we want to do a rejection note, saying if you have a liability already, because then the initial recognition is no issue anymore because they already have it as a liability, it's 39, it's P&L, period. And then the rest goes to the project.
But for those of you who are concerned that we might be going in a different direction from the FICE project, the board's project, of course, the due process requires the board to give its negative clearance on anything that we would publish in the way of a draft interpretation. And I would think it likely that if there are some people on the board, certainly a majority, who feel that we're going in the wrong direction, that they would object to publishing the draft interpretation, so it would never actually see the light of day. So it wouldn't be a question of we would require something that then the board would change a short time following that. The board would act a little bit more swiftly on that point. Tuck?
I share the same view with Bern. And I understand the situation of the FICE project, and it's very complicated. It's difficult. But still, we have discussed something in the FICE project. And once they have reached a conclusion, and that conclusion has not yet denied. So I think first we have to utilize that conclusion, and we have to work in conformity with the FICE project. And also, we could issue some rejection wording just saying it's just a liability because IS 32 says so, and you should recognize gross hit and recognize difference in the profit and loss. That's quite simple, but it doesn't really solve the problem. As Jean-Lou said, there is a basic conflict between IS 27 and IS 32, IS 39. And every time we come to this issue, we come across basic questions. So we've got to do something to do with this hypothetical conflict. And David gave us one solution, but I can't agree with the reclassification approach, because reclassification approach is not simply just reclassification. Actually, it seems to me that this reclassification approach is sacrificing important part of consolidated financial statement, because whether or not we have NCI is very important part of the important element of the finance consolidated financial statement. So I understand to measure the liability correctly is very important, but on the other hand, to measure the NCI is also more important. And just to go to the liabilities, this is not the right answer to provide to the constituents.
Thank you. Andrew?
I personally support the reclassification approach because it gets rid of the double counting, but I acknowledge there are seriously entrenched views out there, and I just don't see us getting consensus on that. And when we talk about, well, let's carry on working on it, I think the only real answer, the only way we'd get a solution, is derivative accounting. And I don't think that's in our power to do that, because it's a significant amendment to IAS 39. If it was, that's great, but I doubt it. And so I don't think there's much point carrying on debating those other issues, because I see that as the only solution, in which case you're left, do we make a decision about the original question or not? And it's that, you know, movements in those liabilities can be quite big numbers, and there's a lot of diverse, you know, if one takes it through equity, one takes it through P&L, that's pretty unfortunate diversity, and I recommend that as the second best, albeit not great, solution dealing with that issue.
Okay. Can I ask the ISB board members for some comments in a moment? I suppose the position that I'm looking at now is that there is certainly the sense I've got from the committee's views, which you've all managed to express, that we don't have consensus, that no matter which direction we're going to go in, there would be a significant number of people who would object to following that particular route. So that's one of the agenda criteria to reach a consensus in a timely period. I don't think we're going to be able to meet that. What's perhaps more important, though, the reasons why there's a difference of opinion. There are some that say, well, IS-39 is clear what you do with that, but it creates problems, and it creates problems that we need to solve, and there are some solutions that are being proposed by the staff. There are other solutions that Laurence and I'm sure one or two of you as well would come up with, which might address the issues. But the more it gets to resolving, I think what Andrew has described as being the fundamental decision, the fact that this put is a derivative, but we're accounting for it as something else, as a gross liability, that this is creating a tension that you're uncomfortable with. Some of you equally, of course, still reminisce about the days when you could put all sorts of things direct through the equity because it didn't disturb net income or profit and loss in any way at all. And that seems to be more consistent with some of the language that we've got that was introduced from business combinations and IS-27 for transactions among equity participants. The mezzanine approach that used to apply to non-controlling interests or minorities, as we even I acknowledge, Ruth, that we did call them minorities in those days, politically incorrect today, but that treating them in the mezzanine perhaps was a better way of informing people what's happening. But the question of divergence and continuing divergence is one thing that concerns me. I would hope that regardless of whether these changes in the value of the liability were going direct to equity or going direct to profit and loss, that they are clearly labelled and disclosed so that from an investor perspective that the financial statements, even though they arguably are in the wrong place, are at least providing the information about the transactions that were taking place. It would be much more egregious if some of these items were just lost, mushed into other figures in the financial statements, so there was no prominence given whatsoever to material exercise put options. I think the committee has to come to a decision. The decision, unfortunately, seems to be that we can't take this further on our agenda. It goes without question that the input that has been provided to this committee is something that can be shared with the FICE team, will be shared with the FICE team, will be beaten into their heads that we have spent a lot of time debating some very difficult issues. And perhaps, and I'm not suggesting this is the format of an agenda decision, but you might like to think of this over lunch and then we'll come back to it when we return, that we should make an agenda decision that acknowledges that IS-39 recognizes this as a liability and IS-39 would recognize changes in liabilities to be booked through profit and loss. That part of the standard is clear. But to acknowledge that it creates some additional problems in dealing with the double counting issue and many others, and that because the FICE project is underway at the moment, this is an opportunity to actually look at resolving the issue fundamentally through a change rather than interpreting what is already there. And it would be unusual, I think, for an agenda decision to recommend a disclosure, but at least it's something that we should put in, that we would expect that this is additional information that companies would report anyway in accordance with the requirements of IS-1 for significant additional information, the way in which they are accounting for the put options and the way in which they're presenting them. But again, to be clear, that IS-39 at the moment requires these to be accounted for as a liability. I don't think we can escape making that observation. And then to encourage the board to race through their decisions on the FICE project as expeditiously as possible, and as a consideration of that, as we did in one of the annual improvements on comparative information, to take a piece out of the board's project, if it's considered necessary, that addresses this particular issue, that can then go through as something which is a shorter term or a nearer term amendment. in the form of annual improvements that we know is consistent with the board's thinking because it's the language that's going to be in the board's exposure draft, and to expose that in annual improvements. But I won't ask you to comment back on that now. I suggest we adjourn for lunch and return at 1:45. Yeah. Not used to working so long in the morning. Different time zone. Yeah, come back at 1:45 and then we'll just take comments and make a decision. Thank you.